Excuse me, this is the coordinator. I'd like to remind all parties this call is being recorded. If you have any objections, please disconnect at this time. Thank you. You may begin.
See, when you join something on my... Trina, are you there?
Trina there? I heard somebody, but it sounds like we may have gotten cut off.
Yeah, I was checking to see if Trina was muted.
Have you started the recording?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. And I think the operator has joined me back in. Can you all hear me now?
Yes.
Oh, good. All I could hear was music. Okay, and she made the announcement for starting the recording.
Yes.
Okay, thanks, Rosalie.
Well, welcome, everyone, to the CHARM telecon for June. We have a very exciting presentation for you today. As is our tradition, the CHARM telecon in June is our anniversary edition. As most of you know, we arrived at Saturn on July 1st of 2004. And once every year, we ask five science experts, one from each science discipline, to summarize the major highlights from their discipline over the last year. And today, we are joined by an outstanding panel. Dr. Rosalie Lopez is the investigation scientist for the Cassini radar team, and she will be sharing with us all the highlights of year three, which many on the mission call our Titanian year, and you'll find out why in a little bit. Especially, she'll be giving us some of the highlights from the radar team and the radar instrument. Dr. Paul Helfenstein, who's on the Cassini imaging team, he's an associate with them, he'll be bringing us up to date on what's been happening with the icy satellites over the last year. Dr. Kevin Baines will be joining us a little bit later. He's the lead Saturn scientist for the visual and infrared mapping spectrometer, and he will actually be calling in to us from Europe today. He's at a science meeting there, and he'll be discussing with us everything about the giant gas planet that we've been orbiting now for 3 years, and he'll be telling us what we've learned about it in this last year. Our fourth panelist is Dr. Tomas Gombosi. He's the interdisciplinary scientist for the magnetosphere, and he is also actually taking time out of an important conference today to share with us the highlights from the last year. And finally, Dr. Jeff Cuzzi, who's our interdisciplinary scientist for RINGS, he'll be closing out the telecon with all of the third-year highlights from RINGS scientists. So with that short introduction of the panelists, let's go ahead and get started. Many of you are already familiar with the Cassini-Huygens mission, but for those of you who have joined us recently, I wanted to do sort of the five-minute introduction to the mission. So if you all go to slide 3 of the presentation, you'll see a nice graphic here. The Cassini-Huygens mission to Saturn is very international. We have over 200 scientists and even more engineers spread out over 17 countries supporting this mission. On slide 4, you see a very nice diagram of the spacecraft. The spacecraft is very large. It's one of the largest interplanetary spacecrafts ever flown. It stands at an amazing 22 feet tall and weighs in at over 6 tons when it's in Earth's gravity and fully fueled. It's extremely well instrumented. We have 12 instruments on the orbiter and 6 on the probe. We're not really going to be talking very much about the Huygens probe today. We did have an excellent review last year in February by Dr. Ralph Lorenz summarizing the results of the Huygens probe mission. It was a very, very nice CHARM telecon, and I would recommend that everybody download that presentation and audio file if you haven't already heard it. So we really don't have time today to talk too much about the probe, but all that great information is there in Ralph's presentation. So again, summarizing the instruments on board the orbiter, we have 12 instruments on board the Cassini spacecraft, and they break down into 3 basic categories that you see there. We have optical remote sensing instruments. There are 4 of them. These are basically cameras at various wavelengths. They are all co-aligned. That means they always look together at some remote target and take images, either Saturn, Titan, the ring, something like that. So they're always looking at things that are far away, remote things. We have 5 magnetospheric and plasma instruments, which we sort of collectively call MAPS instruments. These are instruments that are more interested in measuring the local conditions. How many dust particles are there in the area, you know, right now that the spacecraft is flying through? What is the strength of the magnetic field right here? That sort of thing, the fingers of the spacecraft, so to speak. And then finally, we have 2 microwave remote sensing instruments. These 2 instruments use the high-gain antenna to either send microwave signals from the spacecraft to Earth when something interesting is in the way, like the rings, and that way we learn about the rings of Saturn, or the radar instrument uses the high-gain antenna to bounce a signal off a target, like Titan, and receive it back at the spacecraft. It's a very effective instrument for high-resolution surface mapping of Titan. And then just to remind everybody of a few dates, we launched in October of 2007, so our 10-year anniversary is coming up later this year, very exciting. Everybody's starting to plan T-shirts and things like that already. We arrived at Saturn 7 years after that, on July 1st of 2004, and we are currently completing our 3rd of our 4-year primary mission. That's sort of some of the highlights that of the mission. Of course, we had 75 orbit. In the prime mission, in the 4 years, we had 75 orbits of Saturn. We had 45 targeted Titan flybys and 9 targeted icy satellite flybys. Sort of the basic stats. Okay, if you go on to slide five. Slide 5 is a nice figure of Saturn with its majestic ring system. This figure is to scale, to give you some sense of the size of the Saturn system and the rings. And there are the Earth and Moon, both to scale with their distance. And, of course, the magnetic bubble that surrounds Saturn is quite a bit larger than this entire slide here. And there's a very nice graphic of that a little bit later that you'll see. If you go on to the next slide, slide 6 now. Slide 6 has 2 panels. In the upper panel is a figure with all of the satellites of Saturn to scale, and this is a figure that's been updated recently by our mission planning team, in particular Dave Seal, who's very, really, really good at putting together these graphics, and he's actually collected images taken by the Cassini spacecraft for this diagram here and updated it with actual images, which makes a very nice update to this famous graphic. All of the icy satellites here are to scale. You can see Titan, much, much larger than most of the other icy satellites. In fact, Titan is the 2nd largest moon in the solar system and is larger than the planet Mercury. On the bottom panel, we also have another graphic to scale of the system. You can see Saturn on the left with its main ring system, and then all of the icy satellites that are sort of embedded close to the main rings. And then you've got Mimas, Enceladus, Tethys, Dione on this actual, and Rhea on this screen here, and then Hyperion and Iapetus and Phoebe and Titan are all far off to the right. But also a very nice graphic to give you a sense of scale of the Saturn system. So let's go on to slide 7, which is a summary of the 3rd year of our Titanian, what we call our Titanian year here on the mission. The Cassini orbiter has completed its 3rd year, and all orbiter systems are performing normally, and all consumables are running per predict. That's a really great place to be, about 3/4 of the way through your prime mission. We arrived at the magnetotail, and then we proceeded with the 180-degree transfer. The 180-degree transfer was a really terrific mission phase for many of us. It achieved sort of 3 goals all at once. It rotates the pedals from midnight to noon. Now, recall that when Cassini orbits Saturn, it orbits in an ellipse, and so the pedals stick out in some direction, and then relative to the direction of the sunlight coming in, we call those pedals, if they're pointed towards the sun, we call it noon, and if they're pointed away, we call it midnight, and then dawn and dusk. So we did a nice rotation of the pedal by sort of going up and sliding over. So the pedals rotated almost 180 degrees, which is where the maneuver gets its name. It has many, many low Titan flybys, which is always exciting for the science teams here. And also it cranks the orbits up to high inclination, which both rings and magnetospheric scientists very much like to have that happen. This was a real breakthrough in the initial prime mission tour design. Before the 180 transfer was discovered, what we used to do was rotate around the pedals by staying in the equator, because that's how you can do it cheaply, and then you used to crank up and to higher inclination, and then crank down, and then rotate some more. And so being able to crank up and flip the pedals to the other side and do a lot of time flybys all at one time was really a coup. And you can imagine how pleased the scientists were when the tour designers came up with that one. It was a good day for Cassini mission planning. Okay, so let's see. The spacecraft has returned a staggering amount of data in the last year, 68 gigabytes, just a fantastic amount of data. We've completed 22 orbits, 19 targeted flybys, again, almost all of them Titan flybys in this last year. And let's go on to slide 8. On slide 8, you see a nice graphic also produced by our mission planning team. This plots a series of interesting parameters over the 4-year prime mission, and you can see there the 180-degree transfer fairly easily in the inclination profile, and also I've highlighted there the Titan flybys that make that possible. On slide 9, I've included for your reference just a list of all the targeted flybys in year 3 with their targets, their spacecraft event times and dates for your reference. And then on slide 10, sort of highlighted an activity that's been happening this year, which is the science teams and the project have been working very hard on planning the extended mission. And the extended mission goes from July of 2008 to July 2010. This has not yet been approved by NASA headquarters, so this is a preliminary product at this point. We still have to go through a series of reviews from NASA headquarters. I wasn't going to talk about it too much because we're already running a little bit late on time, so I just include it there for your reference because we want to get right into the year 3 stuff. And so at slide 12 is just a nice summary of Titan, just there for reference. And with that, I'll hand it over to Dr. Lopez.
Hello, all. Thank you, Trina, for making this nice summary slide of Titan. In fact, we used to say that Titan was larger than Mercury and Pluto, but now we just say Mercury. And it's a planet in its own right. It's the only satellite in the solar system that has a substantial atmosphere, and that makes it very different from everything else that we have in the Saturn system as well as elsewhere. So I'll just leave you with this basic information, but remind you that the surface is very, very cold, and so materials behave very differently. For example, ice at those temperatures behaves like rock. And on Titan, we have what we call the methanological cycle, which is similar to the hydrological cycle on Earth. The next slide, which Trina also put together, is just a collage of some of the great data that we got, not just in the past year, but before. We see here on the right-hand side, top right, some Huygens data. And I would just like to point out that the figure that says river channels, those are actually mapped. So the white is not on the radar data, they are mapped. But we find clouds on Titan, we find mountains, we find rivers, a lot of geological processes. And I'll be talking more about those individually. The next slide, slide 14, shows an ISS map of Titan. They do not have much coverage of the northern hemisphere yet because that is just starting to come into sunlight now. I'd like to mention here the names for Titan. In fact, there is a website called planetarynames.wr.usgs.gov. where you can find the whole planetary nomenclature website. You can also just Google planetary nomenclature and you get to it. And the each planet or satellite has its own convention with its teams. And on Python is actually very nice because all the names have something to do with wisdom or happiness or peace. And for example, the craters are named after gods and goddesses of wisdom, and the fluctuators, which are like the flows, are named after gods and goddesses of beauty. So we want to keep Titan a happy place. The next slide, slide 15, shows a similar map, but that's made by VIMS, the Visual and Infrared Mapping Spectrometers, using three of their bands. And it's very good to compare what we have with ISS, with VIMS, and with radar. The ISS gives you albedo features, whether something at visible or near-visible wavelengths is dark or bright. VIMS gives you differences in composition on the surface, and radar gives you the higher spatial resolution, let's say geological details on the surface. The next slide, slide 16, shows a radar map. Each radar flyby, we get like a long noodle, about 200 kilometers across and several thousand kilometers long. And what we're using is the synthetic aperture radar mode of the radar. Now, radar can penetrate through cloud and haze, so it's an ideal instrument for Titan. And in fact, I'm sure many of you have seen images of the Earth obtained with radar, because again, that can penetrate the clouds and atmosphere of the Earth. The next slide, 17, shows a schematic of radar. We use five beams to actually construct an image. And we have several modes in the diagram here on the left-hand side. We show the altimeter footprint. That's when we are looking straight down, and we actually get height information only using the central beam. Or we look to the side, synthetic aperture radar, and we actually get the images. Now, radar images can be harder to interpret than visual images. Something that's radar bright generally means rough, but it also could be a slope towards the radar that's being illuminated. So it takes quite a bit of training to get yourself comfortable with these radar images. But you can do that just, you know, if you stare at them long enough or enough of them, you eventually get quite comfortable with them. So, next slide, 18, the geology of Titan from radar. We have found that the surface is very young, very dynamic. There are only three definite impact structures that we have identified. And that makes the surface very young because, as most of you probably already know, the longer a surface is exposed to meteorite impacts, the more scars from these meteorite impacts it's going to have. So Titan surprised us because the surface is very young. We have seen a number of other features that we call suspiciously circular features, and they could be eroded impact craters, and we are in the process at the moment. So at the bottom of the slide, the bottom left, you see one of our impact craters called SINLAP. And then going on, the other geological processes, they're very similar to the Earth. And in fact, the great thing about Titan from a geology point of view is that you find all the major processes that contribute to modifying the surface of planets, of solid planets. You find they're taking place on Titan. We find volcanism, we find tectonism, and those are what we call the endogenic processes that come from the interior. And we also find the exogenic processes, which are erosion and impact cratering. Now, erosion on Titan happens by wind. Titan has an atmosphere, and also by the methanological cycle. We have rivers, we have lakes. So Titan is really the most Earth-like body, I think, that we have in the solar system. You know, in my opinion, Mars is a close second. Some people say that Titan is the Mars of the outer solar system. So let's look at these processes in a bit more detail. And Trina, please keep an eye on time because I know I have a lot to get through. Endogenic processes, we have cryovolcanism, and we see here, some of you may be familiar with these features because they were, you know, mostly from the early part of the mission. Ganesha macula, about 180 kilometers diameter. We have some very large flows. The depressions that the lakes are in at high latitudes, there are some people in the team who think that they may be similar to volcanic calderas. Others think that they may be more similar to karst or dissolution process. We also see Totola facula, which was nicknamed the Vim's snail, which was found early in the mission. But it's just to show you that we do see a variety of volcanic features, but they are not everywhere. We don't see a lot of them. And so far, we have not demonstrated, although there are some hints from the VIM data, that there is some volcanic activity going on Titan at the moment. Now, just a reminder that this material that's erupting in the volcanism is not molten rock or magma like on Earth, but is actually material from the interior of Titan that is cryovolcanic. Is mixtures of slushy ice with probably some ammonia, maybe some methanol. The next slide, 20, shows the Ganesha macula region that is a composite of the TA image and T23 that shows that we have a very large volcanic region with many flows, and we have not seen the whole of this region yet. There are, you know, probably other flows that go both south and north. And that's the largest volcanic feature we've seen on Titan. The next slide shows cryovolcanic flows. Again, the top picture is a combination of TA and T23, and that's an area that's been named Winia Fluctus, very, very large area. And then at the bottom is another feature named Rohe Fluctus, smaller, the flow is coming out of a crater. Now, you might ask, how do we know that these are volcanic flows rather than fluvial? Well, there are some hints, such as association with a crater or a caldera or a fissure that would be very difficult to make from, you know, fluvial. And also some of these are extremely large, which you can explain by volcanic processes, but, you know, fluvial would get harder. And next slide, 22, endogenic processes, tectonism. There is a paper actually in press by Jeannie Radebeau, who is an associate of the radar team, mapping a series of these mountains on Titan. So there are several processes, maybe crustal compaction, thrusting up some blocks, ice from below, some features like Xanadu, maybe a layer of material that's been stripped. But most of the Titan's topography is very subdued. That's what we have been finding with altimetry. And there are some mountain ranges that are 1 kilometer. Also, I'm going to show you one from VIM later on. So there are some isolated mountain ranges, but Titan, it's not a place with lots of very high ups and downs. And there seem to be fewer mountain chains at higher latitudes. That's something that you know, I'm working on at the moment, is the global distribution of these geological processes. Exogenic processes, there are impact craters. These are the three in slide 23 that we have identified so far, Minerva, Sinlap, and Xar. As I mentioned before, there are some suspiciously circular features, but we have not identified them as features. And so far, we have not seen any crater terrains on Titan. And since we have seen about 20% of the surface with radar, maybe there aren't any crater terrains, but you know, it's a little soon to tell. Next slide, 24. Erosion. Erosion plays a key role on Titan, in fact, we find that the landscape has been modified by very Earth-like processes, including forming sand dunes, river channels, lakes with channels running out of them, and so on. We find these river channels at many different resolutions. Huygens saw them, so we know there are some, you know, very small ones. We know there are some very large ones. On the right-hand side, top right, that image is about 200 kilometers high. So there are some river channels that, kilometers in length or more, and then there are some small ones that Huygens has seen. Dunes, I'm going to go a little more into them, but they can be tens of kilometers long as well. Next slide, the fluvial erosion, again showing you some central picture is the same that was in the last slide, about 200 kilometers up. And there are a number of channels distributed all over the swath. So we know that fluvial processes take place all over Titan. Maybe some differences that Ralph Lorenz is looking at in the low latitudes versus high latitudes in the morphology of the channels. Next slide, 26, aeolian deposition. Gianni Radebeau and Ralph Lorenz have both written papers about dunes, and they're mostly distributed around the equator. They can extend up to about 60 degrees latitudes, and this is consistent with the lower latitudes being relatively dry because you can't saltate particles to form sand dunes if they're wet. On the other hand, we do see channels at lower latitudes, so there was probably a difference in time from when the channels formed and when the dunes formed. And then here is a map that is in Gianni Radebeau's paper that's been accepted now by ICARUS. And then the picture at the bottom, you can see how the sand dunes are diverting against topographic highs. Next slide shows again the dunes diversion over topographic highs, the bright area that in fact we call the elephant because it looks like an elephant's trunk. The sand dunes are going around it. And then towards the top of the picture, this is from T21, there are some patches that appear to have far less material. So there's probably, different supply of sand, and some places get more and some get less. Slide number 28. We think that these are longitudinal, or also called linear dunes on Earth. This is a type of dunes that are formed when you have one dominant wind direction. In this case, is aligned west to east, but there are but the wind diverts by a small amount, around it, so that it shepherds these dunes and, sweeps them into long linear dunes. And there is plenty of work on Earth that's been done on these types of dunes. Finally, we go on to lakes, slide 29. Now, a word about the lakes. ISS had seen a feature that looked like a lake, and that's at the bottom left on the South Pole. Now, as I mentioned before, ISS has not been able to image the North Polar regions yet because those are in darkness. But there was, for years and years, a question of where is the methane in Titan's atmosphere coming from? Is it coming from cryovolcanism or from the interior, or are there large bodies of liquid on the surface that are evaporating and supplying the methane to the atmosphere? Back in the 1980s, it was postulated that we might have an ocean on Titan. Titan might be covered by a giant ocean. We have not found that, and we were looking for the lakes, and we did not see them until we had the first radar flyby over the North Polar regions in July of last year, and then there were the lakes. So in T7, as you can see from the top right, a feature that could be a lake embayment, and we think now it is, but we have not seen the really, really radar dark regions, which means that whatever material is there, it's very, very smooth and likely to be liquid. So here you see from T16 and T19, and we have done a series of flybys over the North Polar regions at the moment, and we have a great distribution of lakes, including some that are so large that we are actually requesting the IAU to call them seas. And then I don't know if it will be accepted yet. I am actually the head of the nomenclature committee for the outer planets. So we'll see if I have some influence or not. This next slide, slide 30, shows one of these large lakes that has an island in the middle. And the island is very large, as the size of Kodiak Island or the Big Island of Hawaii. And the next slide, 31, shows a comparison of a Titan lake or sea with Lake Superior. And the Titan lake is greater than 100,000 square kilometers. And the question of whether it's a lake or a sea, in fact, we probably will hinge the argument on the percentage of Titan's area that is covered by a particular feature that we want to call a sea, you know, as opposed to, you know, seas on Earth, what percentage of the Earth they cover. But we found out that there is not actually a very good definition of seas for Earth. And it can get into the same type of argument as the definition of a planet, which I really don't want to go in. Next slide, 32. There is actually a movie that I'm not showing here, but you can get from PhotoJournal. And this is the radar data over ISS. Now, as ISS started to be able to see close to the North Polar regions, they found a large dark area, and this connects very nicely to one of the radar, quote, lakes, the one with the island on it. So we think this is all part of a really large sea. Slide 33, getting to the end now, is a schematic put together by Steve Wall from the radar team about Titan's methanologic cycle. And so it's just to explain how the it works similar to the hydrological cycle on Earth, but it's with methane. The methane evaporates, rains back to form channels, clean out mountain ridges, which, you know, appear bright, and then form debris, etc., etc. Methane is also replenished by from below by a cryovolcanism, so there are probably several processes at play to resupply the methane. Now, next slide is from Vims. I know that I focused on radar, and I'm not apologetic because radar is what I know about. But Vims had a flyby last December, I think it was, T20. That's the highest spatial resolution that they've been able to get with Vims. And they imaged some mountains, and actually found this mountain range, which seems to be the largest yet found on Titan, is about 1.5 kilometers high. We do not have radar data of the same mountain range, but this is consistent with some of the highest mountains we've been able to measure from radar data. They have also spotted some orographic clouds. And slide 35 shows what they're saying. ISS has begun to be able to see the northern regions, and it's going to be, you know, really interesting eventually, assuming we're still flying by then, if ISS can actually get some more overlap with radar. And on the left-hand image, you see here that dark squiggle at the top, close to the terminator, is the sea. that connects to one of the radar lakes. And finally, Titan's atmosphere. I'm not going to go into the atmospheric studies because that's not my specialty. My specialty is surface. But VIMS has found a huge cloud system covering the north pole of Titan, and this is very consistent with the story of the lakes and the methanologic cycle. The methane from the lakes is evaporating and contributing to these huge clouds, which are then causing rain to fall and the whole cycle to go on. So, we have one more slide. In fact, Trina put in INMS and and all the different things that INMS has been able to measure. I would not say that I actually can say the name for all of them, but it's very interesting. The variety of ion compositions that INMS has been able to measure at Titan compared to what they would be able to measure at Venus, Earth, Mars, etc. So Titan is a really diverse, very complex place. And I'm sure that with Cassini, as much as we're making great discoveries, we're going to end up with a lot of questions for a next mission to try to answer. Okay, so I think this is all I have. I'll take a few questions now.
Yeah, let's take a few questions if we have any.
Question. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, slide 37 seems broken in the PDF. Can you describe what it was we're supposed to be looking at?
Oh, I'm seeing it in the PDF fine. It's a table of ion composition at the electron density peak in a solar system ionosphere. So it shows what INMS, what ion compositions they would be able to detect if they flew by Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, and Titan. And it shows you that Titan has the most chemically complex ionosphere in the solar system. So while, for example, on Earth, there are only, five ion compositions that INMS would be able to detect, on Titan, seem like 20 or so.
It's about 50.
About 50.
Yeah.
Okay. Trina actually put together this slide. So would you like to say anything else, Trina?
No. That's I actually got this slide from Hunter Waite. He's the INMS team lead. But that's exactly the concept, is Titan's chemistry in the atmosphere is tremendously complex and tremendously interesting to the chemists. And this is the most chemically complex atmosphere that we've ever detected.
Thank you.
Do we have any more questions for Rosalie?
Yes, I have a quick question.
Okay.
Doubt that these are lakes or seas at the North Pole?
No, although we don't have a... You mean that they are liquid?
Yes.
Okay. Although we don't have any measurement that can say at the moment, okay, absolutely, we made this measurement, we proved it's liquid. The body of evidence is overwhelming. We see the whole morphology is that of liquids. We see channels draining out of them. We see changes in the radar darkness that actually may relate to how deep the lake is. We are actually looking for definite proof. What would, I think, be definite proof would be if we managed to detect a change. And that's what we're looking for, because we have some overlap between flybys.
That's what I wanted to ask you about. Yes, the most recent flybys, I haven't seen anything published yet exactly on that question.
Okay. Yeah, it can be very difficult to unravel because there are differences in look angle that can give you differences in the radar image that may not indicate a real change. So, we're actually doing a lot of work on that at the moment. First of all, the minute that you know, if we convince ourselves that something has changed, then we're going to go to press pretty quickly. And the second thing is that we actually, you know, putting together polar mosaic, they're showing all the swaths, we are, you know, talking about when and where we're going to release that now. You know, and that's colorized as well, so it's going to be quite nice. We were, you know, thinking of saving it for a science paper, but now we found we had too much to say, so we had to publish somewhere else. I predict it's going to come out soon.
Rosalie, one final question. In addition to seeing changes, if somebody detected a specular reflection, that would also be very telling.
Yes, but for the specular reflection, you'd need ISS or VIMS. For the specular point. We may be able to do that later in the mission, you know, so far we haven't been able to. Also, apart from the cup of the seas, these lakes are quite small, you know, relatively small if you're looking for the specular point.
Okay, well, I don't want us to get too far off track. We've got a lot of disciplines to cover today. Thank you very much, Rosalie. Hopefully you can stay online as long as possible to answer other questions. But let's go ahead to our next topic. Dr. Paul Helfenstein is here to tell us about icy satellites in this last year. Paul, are you muted? Oh, don't tell me we lost Paul.
Yeah, you have me.
Okay, there you are.
Okay,
phew.
I was rambling on into my talk here, but...
okay, well, you were muted for the first part, so you have to start over.
Okay, good enough. Thank you very much, and good afternoon. Let's talk a little bit about icy satellites here. Saturn system has 47 confirmed satellites. Most are small and far away from the planet. There are 8 major icy satellites, not including Titan. These are Mimas, Enceladus, Tethys, Thyone, Rhea, Hyperion, Iapetus, and Phoebe. The major ones are located outside the major ring system, varying size from Phoebe, which is 137 miles in diameter, up to Rhea, which is 950 miles. Their surfaces are dominated by water ice and mostly shaped by the forces of tectonics, impact rating, erosion, in the case of Enceladus, even cryovolcanism. The densities range from about 0.6 grams per cubic centimeter for Hyperion to 1.6 grams per cubic centimeter for Enceladus. If you go to next slide.
Could you speak up? We can hardly hear you.
Oh, okay. Is that better?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Yeah, I have a headphone on, so I can use my fingers and the keyboard here. Okay, you've seen this cartoon before. I'd like you to pay particular attention to the bottom one. We're going to be talking mostly about the larger satellites, Mimas through Rhea and Iapetus. And what I want you to pay attention to is the position starting from Mimas and moving outwards toward Rhea of the major satellites relative to the E-ring. E-ring is a thin diffuse ring that actually has wings that extend far beyond the orbit of Enceladus. Enceladus seems to be embedded in the middle of the E-ring, and there's probably a good reason for that, as you'll see a little later. Okay, next slide. Okay, it's been, as you probably surmised from the earlier slides, it's been a pretty quiet year for icy satellites other than Titan. That's not to say that we haven't gotten any new data at all. There are sort of 3 classes of images and data that we've gotten this year. The first are zero-phase images of Dione, Iapetus, and Enceladus. By zero-phase, I mean images where the phase angle is zero, so that they look, they're illuminated sort of like the same way the Earth's full moon is illuminated, where the whole disk is visible and illuminated by sunlight. These are neat to people who do photometry because they provide our most accurate measurements of albedo and color for the satellites. Because you can see zero phase from Earth, they provide a very good tie to Earth-based telescopic observations and observations, say, from the Hubble Space Telescope. These fall within the area, and they actually define the opposition effect for each satellite. The opposition effect is a peculiar optical effect. An amplification of light that tends to happen almost always at very tiny phase angles and can lead to reflectances, oddly enough, greater than unity for things like Enceladus and snow and frost-covered surfaces. In addition, we've gotten some new close-up views of Tethys, Dione, Rhea, and Mimas. They're on the order of about a kilometer or pixel per better resolution. So this will help us complete our global mapping of the satellites, and they provide new geological details about features and topography, because they provide us with stereo views often of features that we can use to interpret elevations. Using terrain maps, for instance. And finally, we've gotten a few new Enceladus plume observations. These, as you will recall, in 2005, Cassini discovered that this little 500 kilometer sized moon Enceladus is actively cryovolcanically active, and it's erupting huge plumes of water vapor and ice particles out the directly out of the South Pole through a series of parallel fractures called tiger stripes. These new data will actually allow us to look for temporal changes in the eruptions that might be, for instance, associated with tidal flexing of the solid surface of Enceladus. Go on to the next slide. I can go on to the next slide here. Okay, the next slide should show you satellites at opposition. These are what we, the ones that we have from Cassini that are illuminated at or near zero phase. we have Dione, Iapetus, Enceladus, and Rhea. I have not done anything to the sizes of these satellites to adjust them to their correct relative size, nor have I tried to change their orientation. What I have done is radiometrically corrected these satellites so that their relative brightnesses are correct for things that are close to zero phase. So you can see that in Iapetus, you have Cassini Regio, which is that very, very dark spot that covers nearly half of Iapetus. The brightest features that you would see, or the darkest features that you would see there, are on the order of 8% at zero phase. In contrast, Enceladus, brightest areas of Enceladus actually have albedos of about 1.4. In other words, it seems kind of odd, but this opposition effect business can lead to reflectances that are almost 50% higher than unity. Go to the next slide. Should be 42. Okay, 42 is an example of some of the close-up views. I'm not going to go through all the close-up views, because otherwise they'd just be showing you a lot of craters and fractures. But this is a representative example of Dione images that we got in April 25th of this year. The resolution, best resolution here, is about 700 meters per pixel, and it shows the leading side of Enceladus, of Dione. On the right, you'll see actually one of the close-up images for scale, that crater with a prominent central peak. I think that's about it's about 60 kilometers in diameter. There's a large basin immediately above it. That's on the order of 250 kilometers in diameter. So you basically see some old impact craters with prominent central peaks. There are some interesting fractures that we're looking here toward the South Pole. So these fractures seem to be roughly north-south trending. I guess this will allow us, these types of images will allow us to do more complete global mapping. And it's really the global maps that show us most of the interesting geology. So that's a project in work for all of these satellites. Okay, and rather than go on and show you a lot of pictures of craters, I thought I'd talk about Enceladus. Whereas we haven't gotten a lot of images, a lot of progress has been made in the scientific analysis of this body in particular. First, just to review some basic Enceladus properties. It's got a triaxial shape, and it's got a mean radius of about 250 kilometers. Its density is 1.6 grams per cubic centimeter, so it's actually significantly denser than ice. If you were to take all the rocky, all the non-ice material, and basically send it to the center of Enceladus and bring all the water ice toward the surface, you'd have a crust or an outer layer of ice that might be on the order of 100 kilometers. Its gravity is 11.3 centimeters per second squared. Compare that to Earth, which is like 980.6 centimeters per second squared. It's very tiny gravity. It's like a lot of these large satellites, it's locked in synchronous rotation around Saturn, so that the same side always faces Saturn. It rotates on its axis and orbits Saturn once every 1.37 Earth days. The mean surface temperature is about 72 degrees Kelvin, or 330 degrees below zero Fahrenheit, and it's got a visual albedo of about 1.4, and that's confirmed from Earth-based observations from Hubble telescope. Well, we go on to the next slide, slide 44. Okay. As you mentioned earlier, one of the most spectacular things that Cassini, I think, has found is that Enceladus is erupting these huge plumes of water vapor and ice particles out the South Pole. And this image that I've shown you from April 24th of this year, the South Pole is actually to the right. So we're, you know, so essentially what you see are a series of plumes. If you look really closely, you can see individual jets emanating from the surface. Through a lot of study with particularly with Carolyn Porco and her group, they've been doing stereo analysis and triangulating which particular parts of the surface these plumes are coming from, and they conclude that they are coming through a series of rifts through the surface that are affectionately known as tiger stripes. If you go to slide 45, Cirrus has also found that the tiger stripes are unusually warm compared to other parts of the surface, on the order of 80-85 degrees Kelvin. For regions their spectral spatial resolution isn't quite enough to see deep down into the central part of the fractures, but essentially though they could be more than a few degrees warmer than the average surface. In any event, the warmer elevated temperatures and the fact that the plumes seem to be erupting from these tiger stripes suggests that either there is a reservoir of water underneath, like an ocean or under a surface aquifer, or more recently, Kiefer and others have suggested that there are materials, unstable materials that are water bonded, called clathrates, that when they're exposed to vacuum and slightly elevated temperatures can release their water, and that's perhaps another alternate possible a reservoir for the types of materials that are forming the plumes. At this point, it's a mystery. Nobody really knows what's causing the plumes, whether they're from a reservoir of water or a reservoir of clathrates. There's some interesting work though that's been done that to provide some tests of what might be controlling the plumes themselves and when they occur. Some recent work by Herford et al. Has been published in which they consider the possibility that tidal flexing of Enceladus, that as Enceladus goes back and goes around its orbit, it actually flexes back and forth, and the tides can introduce stresses at the surface that can reactivate fractures that are already there. They can more or less open and close them. So on the right part of this slide, you'll see a cartoon that shows the outlines of four major tiger stripes, and the areas in green are areas that Herford et al. Predict should have been opening up, for instance, during this last observation on April 27th. I can't say too much about the work that's being done because it's unpublished. But what has been reported so far suggests that there's sort of partial agreement with this model, but it's inconsistent. Okay, if you go to the next slide, slide 46. There is an alternate theory. One theory, I was mentioning, is that there's a reservoir of water under the surface of the South Pole, and if there is, based on the spacing of fraction of the tiger stripes themselves, we estimate that the thickness of the crust or the thickness of the lithosphere there may be on the order of 10 kilometers to 30 kilometers. So if the water is there, it may be very deep. The alternative model that there may be clathrates has gotten some more recent attention by Nimmo et al. This year, in which they know that these clathrates are cold, and heat will cause them to release their water vapor. And as a mechanism for producing this heat, they've also looked at a tidal deformation mechanism, and they point out that during different parts of the orbit of Enceladus, the tidal stresses can result in the tiger stripes shearing back and forth, sort of like you're rubbing your hands together, and that may produce enough energy to cause the clathrates to become unstable and release the plume vapor that we see. Let's go to the next slide. Okay, so it's probably no coincidence that the eruptions that we're seeing are happening exactly at the South Pole. And in 2006, Nimmo and Pappalardo provided a good working, what I would call good working model of why the area of volcanism has ended up at this sort of peculiar orientation exactly at the South Pole. What they postulate is that there may be a warm plume material that's lower in density than the surrounding ice that causes Enceladus in its rotation to become off balance enough or perturb the moment of inertia enough that over time it actually ended up trying to reach a more stable rotational scheme, which places it at the South Pole. So they provided a mathematical model that seems to make sense, but so far, you know, over the last year and probably over the next few years, we'll be looking for proof that this might have actually occurred, or if it if some variation of it occurred. Go to the next slide. Okay, well, I'd like to focus in a little bit more on the South Polar terrain itself. It's a very peculiar terrain on Enceladus. There are almost no impact craters that can be found, so we know that it's very geologically young. It hasn't been around long enough to accumulate impact craters. It's roughly about 200 kilometers in diameter, with a circumpolar chain. In this slide that you'll see, where you see letters that are called A, B, and C, there's basically separated. The South Polar terrain is separated from other terrains by a very distinct circumpolar chain of scarps that are on the order of a kilometer or so high. The area covers about 70,000 square kilometers, and it's in addition to these scarps, you'll notice the areas points labeled A in this feature show that there are these little cuspate intersections that are very reminiscent of similar types of features that we see due to buckling on a sphere or even plate tectonism on Earth. Over by B, these intersections take the form of something that looks a little bit like a wedge and may in fact be acting like a wedge. If you look very closely in these features, these discontinuities in the margin called B, you'll see actual icy mountain ranges and little fold belts. The mountains are on the order of a kilometer, a little less high, but there's very strong indications here that what's happening at the edge of this margin is that there's compression
Hello.
Going on, and the
ice. Hello, how are you?
Pretty good. The ice is being forced northward relative to the tiger stripes that are seen sort of in this view as being kind of green in color. And go to the next slide. Okay, we have here in the next slide, we've been able to use over the last year or so, we've been able to use stereo information to derive some topography of the South Polar region. You can see actually that it's a topographically depressed area. Toward the center, it's roughly 500 meters below the average Enceladus height. The mountain chains, which you can see color coded here as well, are on the order of hundreds of meters above the mean surface. So the total drop in topography from the top of the mountain to the floor of the South Polar terrain is on the order of a kilometer. Okay, we've done some preliminary geological mapping of Enceladus. On slide 50, you'll see a view of, from on the left from looking from the South Pole, a stereographic, polar stereographic map, and on the right looking down at the North Pole. And right away, you begin to see some very interesting symmetries. First of all, you can see in pink the South Polar terrain region. The arrows labeled A show that sort of the directions of force that are implied by the morphology of these mountain chains that seem to form around the outer periphery. You also notice in blue these areas that are represent old crater terrain, areas that haven't really been tidally disrupted too badly. There's an interesting symmetry here in that the because Enceladus is tidally locked, the plane that goes from 0 degrees to 180 degrees in longitude and around the poles is, you might call that the tidal plane. Well, the areas of old crater terrain seem to form almost a band all the way around Enceladus, but perfectly sort of aligned or nearly perfectly aligned with the Saturn-sub-Saturn direction. On the leading edge and trailing edge of Saturn, of Enceladus, however, the surface is badly sort of tidally broken up into a very elaborate series of different terrain provinces that vary in age. If we go to the next slide, okay. If the only thing had happened, this represents kind of the first level of a test of the Pappalardo idea that polar wander has occurred. If the only thing that has occurred over time was polar wander from one mantle plume, for instance, or one perturbation, you might expect that Enceladus would be completely cratered except for the South Pole. In fact, we find these many other areas that are also tectonically disrupted. So in this particular view, we found features that appeared to be almost relic features of what might have been ancient areas like the South Polar Terrain that may have erupted in the past and shown similar patterns of and spatial arrangements of tectonism. So in this particular slide, it's a polar stereographic projection like the one shown earlier, the South Pole, except now we're pointed at the equator in an area called Serendip Planitia. And what we see is an area that the bluish material, the crater terrain, sort of wrapping around at least part of this, in about the same geometry as the perimeter of the South Polar Terrain wraps around that province. If we look a little closer at these images, go to slide 52. What we see are labeled D features that crudely look reminiscent of tiger stripes in both their placement and orientation. We also see features like that labeled C that appear to be features that may have formed under compression. These are ridges that look as if material has been extruded up through them, perhaps by compressional forces. In the area labeled A, you can actually see sort of an arcuate band of groove terrain that, at least in plan form, resembles some of the banding that's seen in the South Polar Terrain. Now, the topography is very subdued. But what's interesting about the subdued topography is that nearby there are craters that appear to be relaxed. In other words, they've been heated from below, and their topography is sort of partially melted back into the surface. And one hypothesis about this band is they're sort of pulled up near A, is that it might have at one time looked more like the mountain chains around the South Polar Terrain, except over time being exposed to heat, it may have viscously relaxed so that you see very little topography, but you still see the old platform. Okay, so go to the next slide. Okay, and I'd like to return now to the Enceladus plumes. As I mentioned before, the Enceladus is embedded in the E-ring, and this is one of the images that was returned last year. The little dot there with sort of that's sort of highlighted in the inset is Enceladus. You can see sort of the bright overexposed area below are plumes that are coming out of Enceladus, and there are actually little filaments of water vapor and ice that are you can see twisting around Enceladus. This is sort of the smoking gun, if you will, that shows that Enceladus is actually the culprit that's been feeding the E-ring with ice particles. Okay, now this makes it more interesting. If you go to the next slide, okay, Enceladus is a bit of a graffiti artist. I've stolen the title here from a recent paper by Ann Verbiser. And Ann Verbiser has been analyzing Hubble Space Telescope data, again, observations of the Saturnian satellites at exactly zero phase, as we were talking about before. And so what you'll see in this figure is a plot. There are two panels. The top show the albedos, or the reflectances, of the major icy satellites as a function of their distance away from Saturn. So the scale here, RS, is in Saturn radii, or multiples of Saturn radii. The radius of Saturn is about 120,000 kilometers. And so what you see is close to Saturn, you see Janus and Epimetheus. They're small icy satellites. And then Mimas, then Enceladus, and Tethys, Dione, and Rhea. Well, Enceladus is obviously, from this plot, the brightest and most frost-covered of these satellites. And as you move farther away from Enceladus, you notice that Tethys is next closest. It's also next brightest. And Mimas is slightly further away, but it's also fairly bright. It appears that as you move further away from Enceladus, the satellites are getting a little darker. And if you also look below, below is a plot of the reflectance, or the albedo, of the E-ring. And it basically mimics the brightness of the satellites. And so the conclusion that we derive is that Enceladus is spray painting its neighbors with frost. There we go to the next slide. And this will be my last one, because I'm probably way over time. But essentially, one thought here is that if it is spray painting its neighbors, you would think that Tethys and Mimas, its nearest neighbors, would just be spray painted white, that you wouldn't be able to see any albedo or color markings. Well, Mimas just about foots the bill. This is a view taken, I believe, taken toward the end of last year of Mimas that shows, I think, it's probably the leading side of, got my notes a little messed up here. Anyways, the only color variations that we really see that are significant on Mimas are due to a large crater called Impact Basin called Herschel. They're very muted color differences. If you look at Tethys, though, over on the right, you'll see that there's a albedo variation and a very peculiar tongue-shaped band that extends, it's parallel exactly to the equator and extends plus or minus 50 degrees of latitude and goes at least halfway around Mimas on the leading side. It's not too prevalent on the trailing side. So if Tethys is being spray-painted by Enceladus, it's being done so in such a way that albedo variations can be preserved on one side and not on the other. It suggests, for instance, perhaps the magnetosphere is dragging ice particles into one side and Tethys itself is shielding the surface from that bombardment on the other side. Okay. I think that's about all I have for you right now, so I will turn the floor over to questions.
We are running over, so let's just take, let's take one question. And if there isn't one, that's okay, because we've got plenty of material yet to go. Paul, are you going to be able to stick around for a while? Or?
Well, I'm going to have to go pretty soon, though.
Okay.
Thank you.
Last call for any questions. One question for Icy Satellites.
What can you tell us about the composition of the plumes?
Plumes are almost entirely water vapor. And Enceladus itself is almost, if you look at VIM's data, surface Enceladus is almost pure water. There are very small trace amounts of carbon, mostly in the form of carbon of frozen out carbon dioxide. People have been trying to come up with trying to see if they could measure something particularly things like ammonia, because for water to exist, the temperature in Enceladus is so cold that one almost needs some type of material to depress the freezing point or to raise the melting point in order to get water. So the people are looking at we're hoping that something like ammonia would exist. And so far, people have only been able to put VIMs and other people have only been able to put limits on the amount of ammonia to be there, and it's generally less than a couple percent if it's there.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much, Paul. We really appreciate you taking the time today. Let's go on to our next topic. Has Kevin joined us?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you just fine, Kevin. We're running a little bit behind schedule, so as long as just sort of keep it moving, we'll be fine.
I'm trying to. I just had a little computer crash, but my computer's finally coming up. I was just looking at our talk, and it just went down on me, but I'm trying to get it back up here, sitting here in France, trying to communicate from a hotel here in France, but it's coming back up. And so I'll have to wait another second or so. But we can just talk a little bit about Saturn. I mean, Saturn is sort of the lord of the whole system that we've been hearing about with the ring system and the satellites and Titan, and they all circle Saturn. And I see that you were helpful here, Trina, coming up with a summary of Saturn here on the slide. And it is the second largest of all the planets in the solar system. Jupiter, of course, being the largest one. I should say that Saturn has a diameter 10 times larger than the Earth's diameter, almost exactly 10 times. So it's got 1,000 times the volume of the Earth. And so it's a gigantic planet. But just like all the large planets, the reason why it's large is mainly because it's made of hydrogen. And hydrogen, as we all know, is the most prevalent molecule in the universe. And so when you can grab onto hydrogen and make a planet out of it, usually it's large. That's the reason why Jupiter's so large and the outer planets are large, because they can grab onto the hydrogen and keep it, whereas the inner solar system planets can't hold on to the hydrogen. Basically, the sunlight basically smashes into the hydrogen and powers them out of the atmospheres, so that you can't really keep too much hydrogen around the inner solar system. But outside of Jupiter and beyond, you can keep it. So we've got the second largest planet in the solar system sitting there, Saturn. The most prevalent component, of course, is helium, comprises around 8% of the planet. There's also methane and ammonia in the planet as trace constituents, down about 0.1% or so. And then there's phosphine and a number of other constituents there, which all together, we believe, kind of give some of the coloring that you see on Saturn and also on Jupiter. We think these are traces, trace chemistry going on with photochemistry, sunlight coming in and smashing into some of these molecules and then creating other molecules that then eventually give you the kind of colors that we see on these planets. The clouds that you see on Saturn, the whitish clouds that we'll be talking about later, we believe are mostly ammonia. But there's an outstanding problem there that no one yet has spectroscopically identified ammonia on Saturn. We've done it on Jupiter, but so far I've been faked out, haven't been able to figure out how to do it. on Saturn, how to get to really spectroscopically identify these as ammonia. But we believe from thermodynamics, knowing how much ammonia gas there is there and seeing the temperatures, that we know that ammonia should condense out and form clouds at that level. So we think that we really got ammonia there. Okay, let's go on to slide 56, or sorry, 57, so I can get my computer to behave right. And the theme I'm going to try to talk about is this, the polar science that we've done this past year. You know, we've finally, with this tour, we've been able to crank up over the poles, and this has allowed us now to really, you know, observe the poles for a long period of time, watch what's going on, and we find that each pole is different. The North Pole has this strange hexagonal feature, which you can see very prevalently on this image, a six-sided feature at the pole, and then the South Pole seems to have a hurricane-like feature, complete with towering eye clouds that rise up 50 kilometers above the base, and you can actually see the shadows of those clouds being cast on the clouds below. So that's sort of a unique thing that we found. So each pole seems to be different, and we'll talk about that a little bit more. So on slide 58, you see a typical, what I call a typical picture of Saturn with its beautiful ring system. It's the planet itself. The left side is lit up by daylight. The night side's on the right. You can see the shadow of the night side cast on the ring system. A beautiful picture there. This has been overexposed in a sense, so it's not quite fair what I'm going to be talking about. But if you just go on your slideshow and then click on the next picture, we've overlaid on there than what it looks like in the near infrared with a picture that was taken a short time after this picture was taken. And you can see a completely different character to the planet. So where in the first picture you were seeing daytime only and you had a nighttime, on this picture here you're actually seeing a red glow all around the planet. And what you're seeing here is the red glow from the depths of Saturn. Saturn itself, just like the Earth, if you go down deep enough, you find heat. And that heat then tries to get out of the planet. And if you look at the right wavelength, in this case 5 microns in the red color, you'll see the clouds above trying to block the heat. And so what you see is clouds in silhouette. And so the black areas on this image in red are clouds that are blocking light, trying to get out from below. And those clouds are deep down in the atmosphere. It's not the thin hazes up above that we see typically. These are distinctive storm clouds and meteorological features that are down at around the 2 to 3 or even 4 bar level in the atmosphere. That is about 2 or 3 or 4 times as deep as the typical type hazes that you see. And so we're looking down at almost 100 kilometers below what you actually typically see with reflective sunlight. And we're getting down to the fun part of Saturn where it's active and we're actually seeing dynamics. What this reveals is that the upper hazes that we're seeing is just the skin of Saturn, and all the excitement is down below. And perhaps these hazes up above, part of the reason why they're there is because of meteorology, things like convection going on, bringing up particles from below and then depositing them in the upper stratosphere and the higher regions of Saturn, where they sit around for a while. But really, a lot of the stuff that we see in the upper atmosphere could be created from down below. Other stuff is created in the stratosphere due to photochemistry. But this type of imagery showing the depths of Saturn is a revelation, basically, of the Cassini mission. And this was done with the VIMS instrument, the Visual Infrared Mapping Spectrometer. Now, on this picture, again, I'm talking about slide 59. It's a very interesting picture because this is a night side view of the rings. The rings you see shimmering away. It's really a translucent image of the rings, and so that's why the rings look different. You see a big black band in the middle of those rings, and that's really because the rings are so thick that it's blocking all the light in that big black belt you see in the rings. But there's other little ringlets around that are actually letting the sun kind of shimmer through, and you see it. So we're looking basically at the North Pole here, which at the back side of the rings here. And then up at the pole itself, there is some sunlight hitting the pole, and that's why you get a little greenish glint. What I've done here, on Saturn, is I've got the red image is the 5 micron glow, sort of an oven effect of the glow of Saturn glow trying to get through. But then I've also combined some reflected sunlight, and you see a little greenish tint to the northern hemisphere. But you see in the southern hemisphere, halfway down the picture, you'll see that all of a sudden it gets brighter. And so that basically tells you that there's a hemispherical difference in Saturn. This is something that we've really been looking into in the last year, that Saturn has a hemispherical difference in upper cloud layers. And so the hazes in the upper atmosphere can reflect sunlight, but they're doing much more prevalently down at the south, than the north. Now, part of that is due to the fact that the sun is shining a lot stronger on the south than the north. It's a southern summer right now and northern winter. So what's happening is that we're getting some sunlight reflecting off the southern hemisphere, but you can't explain that whole difference from that. There's definitely a distinctive difference in the northern hemisphere and the southern hemisphere, almost by a factor of two in the aerosol content, and that's something that we've really started to nail in the last few months. And what we're going to look for now is as Saturn starts tilting back and as the North Pole becomes summer, right now it's North Pole's in winter and coming into almost into spring, as we transition the seasons over the next couple of years, we're going to watch to see if this thing flips, if the North Pole becomes covered with clouds and the South Pole starts opening up so you can see the glow better from the south. So there's a lot of information in this one type of picture, and this kind of shows what you can do when you have multiple wavelengths. You can do a three-dimensional study of an atmosphere. In this case, you can tell readily that over the North Pole we've got very few hazes, but you've got lots of neat clouds deep down, and over the South Pole you've got a lot more hazes up high, and there's also some deep clouds down below, but they're hard to see, again, as being muted, that those southern clouds are muting out the glow coming in from the south, and it basically tells you there's some pretty big particles actually in the South Pole. So there's probably a particle difference in size as well as in content or an amount of stuff. There's actually a difference in the particle size, and the particles are bigger in the south than they are in the north right now. So we'll watch this over the next few years and see if we can see seasonal changes and try to figure out what's really going on with the different types of weather systems and what happens when you have different amounts of sunlight hitting the upper atmosphere and causing different particles to form. Okay, let's go on to the next slide, 60. And again, this explains basically what I was talking about, that we have three different colors there. The red color is 5 microns. Again, the glow of the internal heat of Saturn trying to get out, being blocked by clouds. In this case, every cloud tries to block it, but because the light is 5 microns, only big particles will actually block it very well, and that's why you see those very distinctive black areas, because that's where deep down in the atmosphere there are some very distinctive thunderstorms and things like that that are blocking the light. But the upper hazes are small particles, so they're not going to really do much to red light that's in the northern hemisphere. Then down the green wavelength is 3 microns, and that's just, again, reflected sunlight, and again, but what's interesting here, by the way, you notice that the rings only show blue, and so what we picked here was red and green to be colors that water in the rings would actually absorb the light, and the only color then that the rings show up in is blue, which we picked a wavelength here, which is very unique in that the rings itself reflect it, but Saturn itself likes to absorb it. So in that northern hemisphere part of Saturn, because the 2.3 micron is absorbing in methane and a little bit of hydrogen, you see very little blue in the picture. You do see some aqua color in the southern part of the picture. Again, when you have high hazes over the south, well, then you can actually get some of the blue light to come back and to reflect off and come back. Now, I just had another glitch in my computer. My computer keeps going down. I just lost the image. I'm going to have to try to get back, get this thing back up again.
And I just wanted to give you a heads up, Kevin. We're running late. You've got just about another 5 to 10 minutes.
Well, no, maybe I'll take a question while I'm trying to get my computer to come back up with this thing. It just went berserk on me, and I just dropped the whole talk from my computer. But I could, take a question to you while I'm trying to get it back up again.
Would you? It's possible that Tomas is online. Would you like for us to go to Maps and then come back to you?
I don't know. I'm afraid this computer. Maybe this file is so big that as I go through it, it tends to. Lose it, and it's going to keep happening. But okay.
Look at your original presentation that you sent me, because it was unchanged. If that would help.
Right. That might. That's a good suggestion. But it takes a while to get everything going up again. I mean, this has happened twice now in the last 5 minutes. It was working fine during nobody else was talking. Just 1 minute before we changed, my computer just decided to go berserk on me. So I don't know what's going on, but it's coming up again, and we'll just kind of get down there. So. Well, it's going to take. I have to see what the next picture is. I don't have it on my slide. We can take questions if anybody's got any questions out there while I'm trying to get this thing to come up.
Are there any questions about Saturn?
Yeah, so far. Well, I just wish I remember what I had in the slides.
The next slide is the red north polar hexagon.
Right, okay. So we'll talk about that in a second. It's coming up now. So one surprise that we got was that that when you look at the North Pole, you see this strange six-sided figure, very distinct. Now, it was known from Voyager that it was there at Voyager, but they had a pretty poor view of it in the sense that that the Voyager spacecraft was flying over the equator. And so they, in order to see the North Pole, they had to look at a very long slant path up to the pole. And so they got a very foreshortened, what we call foreshortened view. And they put together a nice image, but they had to wait for the planet to rotate around and kind of piece together what they were seeing. In our case here, we had a beautiful view looking straight down at the North Pole. We're not quite straight down, but from a very good angle. So you can see the whole hexagon in one fell swoop, and you can see it sitting there. And there it is in this picture here where I've got, again, I used red light for 5 microns. Now, again, we're using 5-micron light here to image it, which means we're looking at the glow of Saturn coming through the clouds. And so this is a nighttime view. As was mentioned earlier, Saturn, the northern hemisphere, is at night right now because it's winter up there. It's polar winter. And so you can only see it in thermal light, watching the glow come through. Now, in a year or two, the sun's going to rise and over the pole. In fact, you can see it starting to happen. You can see on that far limb, the blue glow, that sunlight over there, it's on the limb. It's trying to get up to the pole, but it's not quite there yet. Within about a year and a half, they should be getting sunlight at the pole, and they should start being able to see the hexagon in the sunlight. And that's the camera I'm talking about, ISS camera, which has a very good spatial resolution. You can see things very clearly. And we'll be able to do it, too, with our VIMS camera that I'm part of. We also have reflective sunlight wavelengths, as I've shown you earlier. And so we'll both be looking at the reflective sunlight and looking at the dimensionality of this, whether how high does this polar hexagon go. What we see here is that the polar hexagon is a deep-seated feature. We already know from Voyager images that were in reflective sunlight that at least back in 1981, they were seeing it very high up in the atmosphere as well. So we will be getting a full set of data simultaneously looking at high and low in this atmosphere and really seeing how deep this thing goes. So that's slide 61 showing that glowing away. Slide 52, if you click on it, should be a movie, and you should see the hexagon spinning. And what we're looking at there is about 2.5 hours worth of observations done. About every 10 minutes we took images, and again at 5 microns. And the planet, of course, is spinning under us. And the planet rotates in about 10.5 hours, and over that 2.5 hours, it spins about 1/4 of the way around, and you can see those corners kind of moving around about 1/4 of the way. So it's not the actual spin of the atmosphere that we're seeing. We're seeing the spin of the planet is what we're seeing. And so one of the things that we've been looking at, and the next slide shows this on slide 63, is, how fast does this hexagon, this figure, this six-sided figure, actually rotate in the Saturn system? And what we find is that it's rotating just as fast as Voyager found it over 25 or 6 years ago, that it is fixed in what we used to call the nominal rotation rate of the planet. Now, there's an outstanding problem with Saturn, and that is, what is the length of a day on Saturn? It turns out that Voyager measured it using radio signals from the planet and that are generated, we think, by the magnetic field and interactions with the magnetic field. And so the question is, you know, is that rotation rate that you measure with radio, is that the correct rotation rate? And what we found for the first time amongst any planet is that when we revisited Saturn on this mission, we find that the rotation rate by the radio is different than it was in the early 80s. And in fact, on the bottom of the slide, I think I point out, let's see, do I have that down there? I'm afraid of really playing around these slides too much. Oh, yeah, I do have it there. So you can see that in the early 6 minutes difference now than what it was in the early 80s. So we have this big problem with Saturn. Well, what is the rotation rate of Saturn? Because it doesn't seem to keep the same rotation rate. So therefore, what this is saying is that the radio signals are being affected by some other process. There's something else going on, so you really can't rely on the radio signals to tell you rotation rate. It's because the magnetic field, we believe, we know the magnetic field is lined up with the spin of Saturn. And so therefore, you don't have much of a wobble to this magnetic field that you can use to measure the length of the day and watch this, like, lighthouse effect that goes on in the other planets. And the other planets, the magnetic field's offset, and so as the planet rotates, you see this little lighthouse kind of effect come by, and you can just measure it, and it stays very constant. On this planet, it's such a weak signal because the pole is just lined up with rotation that we really don't know what it is. But the dipole, the hexagon here, is maintaining the rotation rate it had 20 years ago, and it's very close to what we saw with the radio signal back then. So one idea might be that, gee, Voyager really did get the right rotation rate, and this guy is fixed to the middle of the planet, and we're seeing changes now due to other external circumstances, which might have to do, one theory recently is with Enceladus, putting out all that junk out there, which then gets in the magnetic field and maybe slows down the magnetic field a bit and kind of drags on it and maybe causes the rotation rate to look like it's 6 minutes longer than it used to be. So we might find that our little clock that we were using for measuring the rotation rate of Saturn is really dependent on Enceladus' volcanism, and if it's not putting out a fountain of water for a while, then things get cleaned up in that outer, in the G-ring, well, then maybe this clock sets back to the right time. So it's very interesting, intriguing kind of thing going on with this clock of Saturn being influenced by, you know, it's like the tail wagging a dog here in the Saturn system.
So, Kevin, I hate to interrupt, but we really need to move much faster.
Well, okay.
Okay.
So now, next image is the nighttime equatorial view of Saturn, and that just shows you a full-up view of the nighttime again glowing away, and you see those features halfway up the planet. Those are the string of pearls, and the next image shows the string of pearls over many days, actually many months here, about 14 months worth of data between this picture and the next picture on slide 66. And so we have this very strange wave-like feature with little brightenings that we don't quite understand going around the planet. So that's another strange thing we've been seeing. And we'll just skip on through 67, which shows the extent of the pearls. And then a very nice movie is on slide 68. Hopefully you can see that. I call that Rolling Saturn. This is Saturn on its side, so you can see it kind of rolling past you as if there's an axle with that hexagon, and it really does display the whole northern hemisphere very well, what's there on Saturn that you can see just by staring at it. This was a 10-hour-long movie we did almost a year ago now. So I'll just skip through that. You guys can look at that at your pleasure. And then the southern hemisphere is showing this very strange belly button-like feature at the pole, which is a hurricane-type feature. It's not really a hurricane. It's almost an inverted hurricane in the way it works physically, but you'd still get the morphology of a deep center, like an eye of a storm, surrounded by a ring of clouds that are high altitude. And the blue picture showed that, and then, of course, on slide 70, I'm showing my favorite glowing again to show what's deep down. And you see those leopard spots all the way around the planet. Those are deep clouds. Some of them are deep clouds, some of them are high, but that shows you just how many clouds are down there blocking the light, and there's a lot of things going on. We think a lot of activity, a lot of convection, and a lot of stuff is just happening at the South Pole, and we're starting to study that as well. Next slide is, it should be a movie if it works right, which shows you that the shadow effect. If you play that movie, it's slide number 71, you'll see the shadows in sort of the middle there kind of rotating around. This is a movie where the longitude, the 350 degrees longitude, is straight up. And so what you're watching is the sun rotating around the planet, and you'll see the shadows cast kind of rotating as well. And that kind of is proof positive that you've got high clouds casting shadows all the way around this thing. First time anything like this has ever been seen on any giant planet, where you have such a huge set of shadows being cast from clouds that are, you know, 50 kilometers above the rest of the planet. So we're starting to study more of the 3D dynamics of that feature. I'm going to skip on now to my computer. Yeah, down to slide 73. That's, again, the hemispherical effect showing up there. I like this picture. It's a beautiful picture. You can see the shadow of the rings on the northern hemisphere allowing, blocking the reflected sunlight, but you still get the red glow of Saturn coming through. And again, you can see that the northern hemisphere is different than the southern hemisphere. On the right, it's bluer, dimmer than it's at the top there than it is at the bottom. And over on the left, you see that in 5 microns, the top is brighter than the bottom. And both effects are due to the same thing. That is, again, the upper atmosphere aerosols being a factor two, more prevalent in the southern hemisphere than in the northern hemisphere. It all works out nicely. And next figure goes into that a little more detail, but we'll skip it, figure 74. And then we talk about, you know, looking at seasonal effects in the future on this. And what else do I got coming up? You know, there's some things here. I mentioned it earlier that the rotation. One other thing you can see in Saturn, and the other thing that can disrupt your radio waves is lightning. And one thing that ISS has done, the imaging people have done is try to find storms at the same time that we're looking at the radio waves. And we now think we have seen lightning in the depths of Saturn, but again, it's done with radio waves and correlating with clouds. and the next set of figures tries to go over that. And there seems to be a periodicity with the storms that were seen with RPWS. So we think we've actually got some storms at certain latitudes on Saturn that have been seen. And the final thing I'm just going to talk about very briefly is, again, that we can also look at the composition of some of the species in the atmosphere. And this is a Sears spectrum here on slide 78, showing some of the species you can see in the upper atmosphere in the top 100 millibars or so of Saturn. And you're getting the methane up there is being smashed into by UV light and by also by some ions and things, so that you can create all sorts of weird chemicals, and that may be some of the hazes that are seen. And then the final one I think here is slide 79, and that shows that these species that you see do vary with latitude as if it's a seasonal effect, and you expect that to happen. That is, if more sun coming in, you might create more things, and that seems to be borne out in some of these things that they're seeing in the upper atmosphere. I guess I do have some a parting shot here of backside of Saturn on figure 80 and 81, and this was a very popular shot, so I put it in here just so people had it again. This is Saturn in eclipse, basically. The sun's behind Saturn, and you're seeing the light shimmering around the rings, but then if you go to 81, you actually can see the Earth back there kind of through the rings. You're looking through the Saturn system, even through the rings, in a sense, the outside of the rings, and you can actually see the Earth and the Moon sitting there, about a billion kilometers away. So that's basically it for now, and I'll take any questions if there's any time left.
Let's take one question only, since we are way behind.
Even though I talk so fast?
I know. I was surprised that it happened. Okay, well, if there's no questions, actually, that's great. We can maybe make up a little bit of time. Tomas, have you joined us?
Yes.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for taking time out of your MOPS meeting to join us. And we're running a little bit behind, but go ahead and take over.
Okay. I'd like to talk about some of the latest discoveries and developments with respect of Saturn's magnetosphere. And slide 83 summarizes some of the basic facts about the magnetospheres of Earth, Jupiter, and Saturn. And there are some very interesting facts here. Mainly that the magnetic field strength at the surface of the planet is about 0.3 Gauss at Earth, about 15 times larger at the surface of Jupiter, but Saturn's surface magnetic field is comparable to Earth's. It's about twice as big. The other very important difference is the rotation rate, which is, of course, 24 hours at Earth. And it's about 10 hours plus minus a little bit, both at Jupiter and Saturn. The consequence is that the ratio of the centrifugal acceleration and the gravitational acceleration at the equator is dramatically different. At Earth is... it's 0.3%. At Jupiter and Earth, it's around unity. At Jupiter and Saturn, it's around unity. So at Saturn, the ratio of centrifugal and gravitational accelerations are quite comparable. The other very important factor is the amount of mass that is added by the planet or the planetary system to the magnetosphere. At Earth, the total mass is coming from the ionosphere, and this is around a couple of kilograms per second. It's due to the outflow from the high latitude ionosphere. At Jupiter, as we know, Io is the engine of the system, and Io is spitting out around a metric ton of material a second. And just for comparison, this is very comparable to a very active comet. So Io basically releases as much material in the Jovian magnetosphere as, for instance, an active comet like Halley released at a couple of astronomical units from Earth when it was highly visible. At Saturn, there are multiple mass sources. and these are the ionosphere itself, which is not very significant. The biggest mass source at Saturn is Enceladus, and this was a huge discovery a couple of years ago, and I think that on the telecon a year ago, that Enceladus plume and outflow, the geysers, any way you want to call them, were extensively discussed. There is some mass coming from Titan and from the rings, but the total mass production in Saturn's magnetosphere is about 10%, 10 to 20% of that in the Jovian magnetosphere. So if someone wants to compare these three magnetospheres, at Earth, the solar wind basically controls the interaction, which is with a very slow rotator. At Jupiter, Io is absolutely dominant. The solar wind interaction is quite insignificant compared to the Io mass ejection. At Saturn, these things are much more comparable, and the delicate interplay between rotational control and multiple mass sourcing, mass loading sources, and the fast rotation, and the solar wind, to some extent, really makes the situation much more interesting, much more complex. So, if we want to understand our solar system, at least in the magnetic sense, you really need to understand the Saturnian magnetosphere. Another very interesting fact is that the size of the magnetosphere, the distance from the center of the planet to the subsolar magnetopause, and the magnetopause is the surface that separates the solar wind plasma from the magnetospheric plasma, is about 10 Earth radii, and an Earth radius is about 6,400 kilometers or so. So we are talking about 60,000 kilometers, which is actually comparable just the radius of Saturn and Jupiter. So at Earth, the whole magnetic bubble is confined to a size that is comparable to the size of Saturn. At Saturn, the magnetopause distance is about 25 Saturn radii, which is over 200 Earth radii. So the whole magnetic bubble around Saturn, the magnetosphere, is much, much, much bigger. Actually, this is the biggest volume in the Saturnian system. So understanding the magnetosphere is really a very important thing. The next view graph basically just shows a schematics of the Saturnian magnetosphere with some of the elements, and this is, I'm talking about view graph 84 now. And this is pretty much just a summary of what I said, that the magnetic bubble is, the shape of the magnetic bubble is basically determined by the fact that the solar wind is streaming from the upstream direction. The dayside magnetopause is about 25 Saturn radii from the planet, and Titan is orbiting at 20. So Titan is orbiting just inside the magnetosphere, and this is a very important factor in basically suppressing the density of ions that originate from Titan, and I will talk about it a little bit later. Inside the magnetosphere, there are various typical plasma phenomena like ring current and auroral phenomena. I will talk about them a little bit later. The mass source, the main mass source region, is the icy satellites, the rings, and of course, especially Enceladus. And then there is the magnetospheric tail, and this extends to a very large extent. To a very large distance, is several hundreds and even thousands of Saturn radii, when you can still measure the presence of ions originating in the Saturnian system. If you go to the next slide, here I just summarize some of the main discoveries this year, what I am going to talk about. The Walter Isaacson Enceladus field, the magnetosphere, with dust and neutrals. And when the neutrals become ionized, they mass load the inner plasma. Mass loading actually means that the newly created ions must accommodate to the plasma flow, and therefore they are accelerated to the general plasma velocity. And this, the energy and momentum for this acceleration process must come from somewhere, and it comes from the ambient plasma. And this process is called mass loading. So Enceladus is the main plasma source, and we made a lot of progress in understanding how it works. The huge surprise this year from the point of view of plasma science was the discovery of very heavy positive and negative ions in the upper atmosphere of Titan, and I will talk extensively about this in on the next few viewgraphs. And this is really why it's so much fun to be on an exploring class mission, because this is a surprise, and it's fun to figure out what's going on. There were field-aligned plasma flows discovered along magnetic field lines, and these plasma flows are strongly associated with the auroral phenomenon. And finally, Kevin was talking a little bit about the rotation rate, the radio rotation rate of Saturn, and as I will discuss, the heavily mass-loaded inner plasma sheet, the plasma in the inner magnetosphere, is the process that creates the change, the variation in the rotation rate and the discrepancy between the radio rotation rate and the planetary rotation rate. So just to cap this together, the magnetospheric plasma sources and sinks at Saturn are Enceladus as the primary plasma source, Titan, and especially nitrogen from Titan, which is the main constituent emanating from Titan. But nitrogen is a minor constituent in the magnetosphere, mainly because Titan is orbiting so close to the magnetopause that the nitrogen from Titan is very, very rapidly lost from the system. And of course, there are other plasma sources, but we are just now starting to understand the delicate balance in the system. And the primary loss mechanism is the so-called interchange instability. When heavily mass-loaded magnetic flux tubes, these are magnetic flux tubes containing a lot of heavy Saturnian ions, change place with light and empty magnetic flux tubes. And this is the process through which the plasma is basically emptied from the Saturnian magnetosphere. The cartoon on slide 87 basically just summarizes the role of Enceladus as the main plasma source, and this is a very nice cartoon basically showing that Enceladus, as it rotates around Saturn, is a very major source of primarily water, and these water molecules get rapidly ionized, and they form the major plasma source of water group ions. These are water ion or OH radical ion or oxygen ion. These are 16, 17, 18, and sometimes in the vicinity of Enceladus, HPO plus is the dominant ion. So mass 19 is also quite abundant in the Saturnian magnetosphere. Slide 88 shows the discovery of the negative ions in Titan's homosphere. Now, probably most of you are not very familiar with the visualization methods of the plasma instrument, so let me just try to explain what you see. these are time, energy, and flux diagrams of negatively charged particles. As Cassini flies through the upper atmosphere of Titan, in this case it's at an altitude of about 1,000 kilometers. Now, I'd like to mention that Titan has a very dense atmosphere. At the surface, the pressure is about four times higher than the pressure at the surface of Earth. So this is a heavier atmosphere than Earth. It's its composition is very different than the Earth's atmosphere. It's full of hydrocarbon, methane, and heavier hydrocarbon. So at 1,000 kilometers, which is just below the homopause, is 1,200 kilometers. The homopause is the region below which the atmosphere and the ionosphere is very well mixed. The concentration of the relative concentration of each species is pretty much constant below this. Above the homopause is the so-called heterosphere, and in the heterosphere, different species have different scale heights. Therefore, the composition rapidly changes with altitude. So, in the upper homosphere, and the upper homosphere means that this is still a well-mixed atmosphere, so it's relatively dense. This instrument, the electron sensor, the electron spectrometer on the Cassini, basically measures the energy per charge, discharge, this is the vertical axis, versus time, and the color color indicates the number of cars, the particle flux. Now, the velocity of these ions is pretty low. Therefore, the relative velocity between the detector or the spacecraft and the atmosphere is pretty much the orbital velocity of the spacecraft. So using this fact, we basically can use the electron spectrometer basically as a mass spectrometer in which we can measure the masses of the individual particles, not only the energy per charge. The surprising thing is that you see these vertical stripes, which I marked as negative ions. These are particles with energy per charge in the 10 to 100, 10 to 1,000 region. This means that these are negative charges where the energy per charge or mass per charge of the particles is in the 10th, the 100th, and even in the 1,000th in units of atomic masses. So these are particles with masses of about 1,000 times the mass of a proton, and that have charges between a single electron and about 5 electrons. And these particles were repeatedly detected on various flybys, T16, T17, T18, and T19. So this is a steady phenomenon. This came as a huge surprise. Nobody expected it. I mean, there were no theoretical predictions whatsoever. So this was a big shock for the plasma science community. The next view graph 89, shows some of the heavy neutrals measured by the ion neutral mass spectrometer and some of the heavy ions. And it shows that the heavy neutrals are heavy organic type molecules, and the heavy ions are the ionized versions of these. These are positively charged ions. On the right-hand side, there is a line plot that shows the number of particles per unit volume at an altitude of 1,000 kilometers as a function of mass. And you can see that these are the negatively charged particles. You can see that the negatively charged particle density actually peaks around 300 and then rapidly drops. This means that these are very, very large particles. Actually, what's happening is that, as it was pointed out in a recent paper by Hunter Waite and co-authors, Hunter is the lead of the ion neutral mass spectrometer team, heavy aerosol formation is taking place in the upper homosphere at around 1,000 kilometers, and these particles very readily can acquire extra electrons. So these form the heavy negative ions, which actually are negatively charged aerosols. The positive ions are the natural, very heavy particles that these are the organic molecules that are formed in the atmosphere. They are relatively well mixed at all altitudes, and they acquire positive charges, and these are the heavy positive ions. Slide 90 shows the altitude profiles obtained as a combination of several Titan flybys. The red squares show the heavy negative ions, and the blue dots show basically the positive ions between 10 and 100 atomic mass units. One can see that the maximum density of the heavy negative ions, the heavy negative aerosols, can exceed 1,000. And the peak altitude is between 950 and 1,000 kilometers. So this is still a huge surprise, to some extent a mystery, and I can tell you that most of the modelers and theoreticians on the plasma science teams are feverishly working on models to understand the phenomena. So the next view graph basically just summarizes some of the open questions, and these are: how do we make positive ions? What keeps them afloat at these high altitudes in the atmosphere? What are the current carriers when the negative charges are in the heavy ions? And where do the ions go? So this is work in progress, and stay tuned. I'm sure there will be a lot of fun papers coming out. The next topic I want to talk about very briefly is the particles that create the aurora. This is on slide 92. And for the first time, we measured by various instruments the field aligned currents. These are electric currents, energetic particle streams that move along the magnetic field lines that connect to the auroral region. And these electrically charged particles, primarily electrons, create the aurora. And on the left side of the slide, you can see three auroral images made by the HST telescope. The next slide, slide 93, shows some of the details of these measurements. On orbit 34, Cassini crossed the magnetic field lines that connect to the aurora region at distance from the center of the planet of about 4 Saturnian radii. On the right-hand side, you can see the plasma wave measurement, and this is again a frequency time spectrogram similar to the spectrograms I showed before. So time is on the horizontal axis, the frequency of the wave is on the vertical axis, and the color basically represents the intensity of the waves at a given frequency and a given time. The auroral hiss is that red streak between 10 and 1,000 hertz near closest approach. And this closest approach was exactly when the spacecraft intersected the auroral magnetic field lines. And this auroral hiss is associated with the field-aligned streaming particles that will hit the atmosphere and generate the aurora. So this is really not unexpected, but very important discovery. The next shows the actual particle. The next view graph 94 shows the actual particle measurements at these times. These are again spectrograms, and you can see that there are, on the frequency diagram, there are the auroral beams between about 10 and a few thousand hertz, and there is an insert showing the particle fluxes which coincide with these streaks. So these are actually the auroral hiss coming from the particles and the actual particles streaming down the field line. The next view graph ViewGraph 95 deals with a different subject, and this is the subject what Kevin was talking about a little bit, that one of the mysteries what we are still trying to figure out is that the radio rotation rate of Saturn and the physical planetary rotation seem to be different. This view graph basically summarizes a number of measurements from Voyager to Cassini, optical measurements and the radio measurements. And the most important is that the minimum rotation rate, the slowest rotation rate, basically comes from the radio rotation measurement. And this is also varying as time goes on. So even the radio measurement, the radio rotation rate, is not constant. It's slowly varying. And Kevin indicated that the emerging consensus is that the delay or the slowdown of the radio rotation rate is due to some kind of plasma process. And some of the models are emerging that are able to explain this process. And one of these models is schematically shown on ViewGraph 96. This is the so-called rotational slippage model. And I don't want to go into much details of this pretty complicated plasma physics process. But the bottom line is that the plasma that is primarily originating from Enceladus is fundamentally moving outward in the equatorial plane, mainly because of the very fast rotation of the planet. The centrifugal force focuses most of the mass to the rotational equator. This mass needs to be, as it moves out, its angular momentum must be increasing if it wants to keep up with the rotation of the planet, because the rotation rate remains the same, but the rotation radius increases, therefore the plasma needs to be accelerated. This energy must come from somewhere. And through the electromagnetic coupling between this plasma region and the high-latitude Saturnian ionosphere, the energy is actually coming out of the planetary rotation or the rotation of the high-latitude ionosphere. So since the radio emission is mainly originating from the high-latitude, the difference between the planetary rotation and the radio rotation is an indication of the amount of mass that is produced by various processes in the inner magnetosphere of Saturn, and that is moving outward through various processes, and that is energized more and more by these rotational interactions. So this is where we are with the understanding of the rotation rate, and these are some of the major highlights of the year 3 discoveries. And, you know, the fun is still going on, as Fred Scarf, one of the founding fathers of planetary plasma physics, said many years ago, half of the fun is just to be in orbit. And with Cassini, we are having more than half the fun from being in orbit. So I'm ready to take questions.
Okay, do we have a question for Tomas? No questions? Well, we're running very late, but of course the NASA votes people would never kick us off the line. They'll let us run over as long as it can. Hopefully Jeff is still online.
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, thank goodness, Jeff. You're our last speaker for today, and like I said, the telecom people are not going to turn it off, so you can as quickly as you like.
Well, I'll try to go very quickly because I understand people often have other commitments. So, and I'm going to focus really on the third year of Cassini, and I also suspect it's a regular audience, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on reviewing what the rings are. I think most people that were on kind of know that, but the first chart in here that Trina provided
somewhat summarizes all that. So let's just go right to the next one, slide 98. During the second year of Cassini, we spent the whole year in a geometry somewhat like this. We were in equatorial orbits, so it wasn't a real exciting year from the standpoint of ring scientists, but it gives you a nice indication of exactly how flat and thin the rings really are. In fact, exactly how flat and thin the rings really are is on the order of tens of meters, and that's one of our important scientific questions, which I'm going to get to a little bit later. So let's go on to the next slide. In year three, this indicates a schematic of our orbit. This was already discussed. Pretty much for the whole year, we started off the year kind of going up into highly inclined orbits, and the orbits just got higher and higher until we're at latitudes above the planet of around 60 degrees. And then toward the end of the year, this summer or so, we're pretty much back down recently, more or less in the equator plane. So it's a very, very exciting time for us. We did observations that we have never done before, and we're frantically working on all that data, and all the results are really not yet in. But I'm going to just hit some highlights. Next slide, slide 100, kind of one of the things that emerged this year, the D ring, which is a almost invisible ring that's between Saturn's atmosphere and the C ring, which you can also hardly see in a lot of pictures. The D ring actually was really discovered by Voyager, but Cassini has really advanced our understanding of that. And one of the really cool things that emerged about the D ring this year is it looks like it's got a warp in it, and the top image there is a little bit hard to interpret, but if you look out at the turnaround points, the furthest point to the right, you see that there's sort of a jag or a jog or a zigzag in them right at the furthest distance from Saturn. And that's exactly what you would see looking at the schematic below if you had a very optically thin, almost transparent ring, which we know the D ring is, and it had a little ripple in it, and that is what you would see. You'd see some regions brighter than others, and the radii where the brightness peaks is offset between the near side and the far side because you're kind of looking at the other side of the hill, if you like. So we actually think this is tilted. The inside the blue square shows a high-resolution image of a tiny piece of this region showing these very regular patterns, which have now been observed both from Cassini and also from a stellar occultation by Hubble almost 20 years ago. Or maybe only 10 years ago, where the spacing of those ripples is different. So what we think is something happened, something actually hit the ring not that long ago, maybe in 1984 or so, kicked up a tilted sheet of material that's out of Saturn's equator plane. And as this stuff precesses around Saturn at different rates, depending on where it is, it starts to wrap up like a spiral. And that's what we're seeing. We can actually measure the wrapping rate. So we know this catastrophic collision, whatever it was, happened in about 1984. So very dynamic stuff going on there. Let's go to the next slide, slide 101. This is actually a movie. Anybody who, I won't go over it because the fun of it is in the movie. It's called Ring_Crossing_Movie. And you download this very nice graphic that was put out by the imaging team, but cool thing about it is if you play it, you can see when the spacecraft goes from the lit side through edge on rings, they pretty much disappear. And then we come up on the unlit side of the ring, and the ring looks completely different. So that's kind of fun, but the fun is in the movie. So next slide, 102, gets back to this question, well, how really thick are the rings? This is a cartoon of what we call a classical ring model. What we used to believe 20 years ago shows the particles that are, say, centimeters to meters in size, and they're very spread out vertically over a thickness of maybe 100 meters or so. The particles are widely spaced, and they're widely spaced because they're moving with respect to each other at a speed of maybe a centimeter per second, even though they're going around Saturn at 15 kilometers per second, you know, just like the cars on the freeway are just moving in relative sense, relatively slowly compared to each other. Okay, so this has some observational implications, is that these particles will cast shadows on each other, and the next slide shows the observation that we were planning on using and now have used magnitudes and strain the thickness of the ring. This is called the opposition effect. It was observed from the Earth almost a century ago. It was realized that the rings got very, very bright when the Sun, the Earth, and the rings are all in a line. That is, just like you're flying an airplane and you're looking out the window and you see shadow of the plane on a cloud or in the trees, and you notice that that little patch of trees is much brighter than the surrounding patches of trees. It's because you're not seeing any shadows. All the shadows are covered up by the lit leaves. So you look a little bit further away in angle, all of a sudden it looks darker. That's the opposition effect. Here we're seeing the little bright spot there is actually the Sun in direct back scatter behind our head, behind the spacecraft, and you look a little bit away from the Sun, it's a little bit darker. So exactly how sharp that bright spot falls off an angle was going to tell us whether or not this opposition effect was really the explanation. We can actually watch the Sun move through the rings and then measure how thick the rings were everywhere, not just on an average, but everywhere. So it's a very important observation. So the next slide shows us basically a similar picture. This is one of these blurry pictures from the VIMS instrument, which doesn't have as good a spatial resolution as the cameras do, but what it does have is a lot better sampling of different wavelengths, so it can be used to look at this opposition effect in wavelengths where the rings are dark and in wavelengths where the rings are bright. In fact, and then measure the shape of that opposition effect in both places, or both wavelengths. And what we got was a big surprise, which is that the width in the right-hand plot there, the width of this sharp spike you see here on the left, is actually larger over on the right in the wavelengths where the ring particles are dark, and it's actually quite narrow in places where the ring particles are quite bright. And that's exactly the opposite of what the shadowing effect would predict. So what this tells us is that it's another phenomenon, probably, that's causing this opposition effect. It's called coherent backscattering, where the photons hit the surface and they actually rattle around in the surface of a particle. And then they come back out again and they can interfere with each other. And that theory actually predicts that the shape would be sharper in the regions where the albedos are higher. So this kind of tells us that, well, we're not really seeing shadows at all. We can't really measure the volume density of the rings at all. And the next slide shows you what this probably implies about the vertical structure of the rings, that instead of being many particles thick, they're probably pretty well packed and flattened down into the equatorial plane of Saturn. Because of all these collisions, which are slightly inelastic, they absorb energy and the particles just kind of settle down. So this is a very interesting result. It just came out this year. And so now what we have is a situation where the rings, being so flattened and dense, with the collisions being so slow, even their weak gravity starts to play an important role in their dynamics. That's illustrated in the next slide. There's a movie associated with this slide, which I also, those of you who might have downloaded already can play it. I'm just going to have to describe it. That this thing looks like a field of uniform particles here. Once you turn on the gravity and let everything orbit, these things start to coalesce into strands of aligned strands of particles that then get stretched and torn out by Saturn's tides. So sort of at the bottom of this slide, it gives you an indication of what that might look like. These strands are tilted with respect to, that is, they lie at an angle with respect to the direction to Saturn. So depending on the longitude that you look, they're aligned differently as you see them. So in the upper left, you see this is a slide from the UVIS experiment that watches stars go by behind the rings. That yellow streak is actually a star going behind the rings, and it doesn't always go right through the middle that way. Sometimes they follow these other dashed lines, like indicated by one or two, and depending at the angle on which it goes by behind the rings, you get these different orientations of these wakes. So when you measure the blockage of that starlight by the rings, it varies depending on what your geometry is. So now, because you've got this varying geometry, these stars also come in at different, you might say, elevation angles. Some of them are coming in rather steeply compared to the rings. Some of them come in at rather grazing incidents. the UVIS instrument and also the VIMS instrument, which takes stellar occultation, now are creating and building up what we call a 3D CAT scan of the rings. So with this kind of CAT scan, watching these starlight coming through at all these different angles, we can see structure that's 10 times finer than any of the best camera images. And what we can learn from that is sort of indicated on the next slide. This is the blue line there shows the total optical depth or the amount of material in just in the A ring. That was just the outer or A ring of Saturn. The green symbols show you the amount of material that's in these gaps between these finger-like strands, and you can see that's pretty low. And it varies a little bit from place to place. That's kind of cool. Why does it go up and why does it go down in some places? And the red symbols indicate, because now we have this 3D CAT scan, we can actually say something about the thickness, the vertical thickness of these thick regions, the wakes themselves, compared to their width, their radial width. And what those symbols, the red symbols, show is that they kind of get thicker and puffier as you go out through the rings, and then that maybe it looks like they get flatter again as you go way out in the rings. So that's a very interesting result as well, all new this year. So we're really starting to get a look in at the ultra-fine micro-scale structure of the ring. Next slide kind of shows now the UVIS is continuing to map out the rings in general, not just the A-ring. Now this is the whole ring system here. The A-ring is on the outside. It's mostly blue. Then we have the Cassini division, which is a little yellow. And then that bright stuff in all through the middle part of the picture is all the B-ring. And then the C-ring is over in the left with sort of the undulatory structure and those sort of narrow bands. So the colors indicate sort of where you have more wakes. And where you see a lot of blue, you see a lot of this wake activity, where you've got a lot of these strands and a lot of fragmentation going on in the rings. And the yellow regions are places where you just don't have quite as much. So we're really starting to map this out. The optically thinner regions like the C-ring and the Cassini division don't have much. That's not hard to understand because there's not very much self-gravity there. The B-ring, the outer part of the B-ring where it's very, very thick, also doesn't have very much. It's probably because it's just particles are just too jammed in for anybody to really move anywhere. But the inner part of the B-ring actually shows as much of this wake activity as the A-ring does, and that's a brand new result this year as well. So the next slide actually shows a few more kind of interesting things. I think in the interest of time, I'm going to just skip right over this slide and go on to the next one. Okay, so here's this beautiful picture that was shown before by Kevin. Now we're looking down at the north side of the system from about 55 or so degrees elevation angle. The North Pole is in the shadow. The sun is on the other side, lighting up the south face of the ring, and we're looking through. So as Kevin said, where there's the most amount of material in the B-ring there, that actually looks rather dark. So this being able to observe in these geometries had never been seen before by anybody, not Voyager or anywhere. So we're just getting started analyzing them with models of scattering, which, as you might imagine, are going to be very complicated by all these stranded wake-like structures where the brightness varies with longitude. So that's an adventure that's just getting started. The next slide shows a close-up. In both these slides, they're color pictures, and you get a sense of the sort of tawny tan color of the rings in both these pictures. If you're looking in a low-light situation, you can kind of tell in this picture that it's the Cassini division that's in this runs right through the center of the picture, and that's a little bit more neutral gray in color than the tawny-looking A-ring on the lower left or the tawny-looking B-ring on the upper right. And we've known this for a while, that the color of the particles in the rings is kind of different from place to place. But images like this one are really going to allow us to nail that down. It's kind of a pretty image. If you look at, there's a sort of a narrow ringlet in the outer dark part of the Cassini division. You can maybe tell it's got a slightly different color to it. Just keep that in mind. I'll get back to that in a few slides. Okay, One of the interesting results of the last year is we're really seeing a lot more activity in these gap regions. We're studying, there are several empty gaps in the rings. This is a picture of the A ring. In the middle is the Encke gap, which is about 300 kilometers wide. And then to the lower left, there's a dark gap that's called the Keeler gap. That's only about 30 or so, 40 kilometers wide. And then we have a bright band, and that's the edge of the A ring there. In the Encke gap, you can see all these bright ringlets. In fact, if you look closely at the outer edge of the gap, you can see a broken sort of discontinuous ringlet that's very, very near the outer edge. This one, to my knowledge, we've never seen before. I mean, I've seen ringlets kind of all over this gap, including Voyager saw one very near the inner edge of the gap. It's the first time we've seen one that near the outer edge of the gap. So we know that there is a moonlet in that gap. It's called Pan. It's what keeps the gap cleared. But there apparently are a number of moonlets in that gap because these ringlets don't come from nowhere. They probably come from just stuff getting busted up every now and then. So it's a very interesting situation. The imaging team is continuing to look for more stuff in there. Now, the next slide shows a close-up of that outer gap, which I just showed you, called the Keeler gap. It's a much more narrow gap. Cassini discovered a little moon in there called Daphnis. This is a picture of Daphnis. These pictures are from this year, but Daphnis was discovered a while ago. But we're really starting to get a better handle on Daphnis by tracking it around. We don't know if its orbit really is circular or eccentric, and that whether it's circular or eccentric might help us understand why the ripples that it causes in the edges surrounding it are so spiky as they are. What's happening here is the moon is just perturbing that surrounding ring material. Remember I said the rings, because of the many particles and their general collisions, have the property of a fluid. So here we have like a river or stream flowing over a rock in the stream. There's a ripple downstream from the rock. The ripple is fixed to the rock. The water flows right through the ripple. So here we have ring fluid, let's say in the right-hand side, flowing upwards past Daphnis, and then the ripple is developed up, you know, above Daphnis. On the other side of the gap, the ring material is flowing downward, passes Daphnis, and the ripple. But you see the ripples are different on either side. So that's kind of curious. So that's something that we need to understand dynamically. Okay, next slide. Even more bizarre, I think, is the structure we're seeing in the F-ring, which I'm sure most of you know is the stranded ringlet that lies outside, just outside the A-ring, just outside the main ring. It's got a main strand. It's got a few subsidiary strands. Some of the best stuff we've got this year, like these images here, which show very high-resolution pictures of the F-ring, are just full of action. There's just clearly lots of stuff going on. Things are colliding. You're seeing little clumps with trails following them. This stuff almost never repeats. It never looks quite the same way twice. We know that during last year, Cassini actually discovered a little moonlet that crosses through the F-ring. Sometimes you see it on the outside, sometimes you see it on the inside. So this whole region is just a fireworks display of stuff going on. Very interesting to track all this material. Next slide shows a result that the UVIS team got with one of their stellar occultations. The upper right-hand insets there show a UVIS stellar occultation that went through the F-ring. And just by chance, looks like they actually caught one of these little moonlets. That's what the really small inset shows, light going down to zero, over about 600 meters. So this is, you know, getting a little small even for the cameras to see, but UVIS caught one. So now as we start building up more and more of these events, we can start to look at the size distribution of stuff in around the rings. The larger chart shows numbers of particles as a function of their size. The line goes from the upper left to that empty box. Those are sort of the main ring particles from, say, centimeters in size, 10 meters in size. And then you see the steeper lines that go down to the bottom right. Last year we discovered these objects that are in the A-ring called propellers, and it looks like they're lying on sort of a steeper line that heads down towards these triangles at the bottom, which are actually the moonlets, Pan and Daphnis. So we think there are actually you know, a whole distribution of objects of different sizes in the sort of football field size, 100 meters, couple hundred meters, sprinkled somewhat through the main ring. But this object that you've discovered, which is this gray box labeled F-ring with these red circles, looks like that's somewhat off the line. So there's probably a whole different population of little moonlets sitting out there in the F-ring just waiting to be discovered. Okay, next slide. This is a schematic showing the diffuse parts of the ring system. At the top, there's Enceladus and the E-ring. The bottom shows the G-ring with an arc in it. You can't really see it very well in this. The next slide actually is a movie, but I'll have to leave it to you that that have the movie to be playing the movie. You can actually see this arc move right through your field of view. So that's a brand new discovery. Something has recently happened in the G-ring that's now starting to spread out, and maybe that's what's preserving the G-ring. Okay, next slide is a beautiful picture. I'll say a little bit more about this. It's been shown before, but this was a really unique measurement that Cassini did this third year. We were able to take pictures from way, way far away from Saturn during a time when the sun was behind the planet for hours and hours. So we could do big maps of the system with narrow angles and wide angles, and at scattering angles that are much, much smaller than we can ever see any other way, because we can't look too close, the sun will fry the cameras. So here, because the sun was behind the planet, we could look at these very high phase angles. This is what people call the windshield effect. Like when you're driving into the sun is when you finally notice how dirty your windshield is, because all the little particles that are the same size the wavelength of light kind of focus the scattered light in the forward direction, making them much more visible. So here we can really see the E-ring, very obvious here. The G-ring is also quite obvious, as is all kinds of little fine dust that's sprinkled all around in the main ring. It's just a beautiful picture. Next slide shows, of course, VIMS can do this too, but they're all different wavelengths. So I see the same general thing, but new discoveries by comparing the behavior between VIMS and ISS. Next slide is, I think, a especially interesting result. This is now the Cassini division again. So I showed you a picture before of the Cassini division where I pointed out a ringlet that you could barely see in the outer part of the Cassini division. It's this picture on the right, only stretched around. So here on the right, on the left, showing the same region, this picture on the right, the black and white picture, shows this ringlet in the outer part of the Cassini division you can almost never see. Only in this geometry, at high phase angles, it's the brightest thing in the field. So that tells you this little ringlet is just full of dust. And that's actually supported by the image on the right, where this little same little ringlet is also very blue. Well, we know that blueness is a characteristic of tiny particles. So here we have clearly a very strong case for some ring that we never saw before. Voyager never saw it. In fact, it might not have even been there when Voyager went by. Cassini never saw it in the early part of the mission, and now all of a sudden it's just knocking our eye out. So another kind of evidence for time variability in the ring. Something happened there. Okay, well, this picture has been shown before, so I'm not going to... Let's go on to slide 122. I want to point out, most of you, I think, know what spokes are. Voyager saw lots of them. They've been quite rare with Cassini, but we are starting to see more of them. The explanation for this is that when the rings are wide open to the sun, the flux of sunlight charges up the rings, ejects electrons from the rings, so the rings get positively charged. And all these electrons form a cloud around the rings, so that's all negative cloud. So there's electric field between the rings and the surroundings. If any little dust particle gets kicked up into this electron cloud, it gets charged, and it gets sucked right back down in the ring, like a electrostatic precipitator they use in smokestacks. But as we now are going towards Saturn's equinox, where the sun is sort of set on the ring, so we're going to see more spokes. And we are seeing a few more, as is indicated here. Also want to point out in this picture, some of you might be able to see some kind of feathery, irregular azimuthal variations in the rings. It's not quite regular as you go, you know, from left to right. Some of the structure seems to be sort of irregular. This is a new thing. Next slide shows that too. As we get more and more of these really high resolution pictures that we're getting, you can see sort of in the bottom left, bottom center, there's a band that goes through there. You can see there's actually fluctuations in the brightness as you go around an angle. So this stuff is just flopping and waving around in various ways, very complicated. Nobody has much of a theory about this yet. We're going to need a lot more data to understand that. New thing from this year, though. Okay. So, final, just to sum up, it was a big year for us. We had our highest ever elevation viewing. Lots of our best in-tour observations, which really haven't even been analyzed yet because people are still working on them. This ultra-high phase angle geometry that we got, that we are not going to get again, not even in the extended mission, unfortunately, revealed all kinds of new rings and ringlets in the main rings. We've been constraining these self-gravity wakes. We got the new irregular structure. All this dynamic stuff going on in the F-ring and the D-ring, this collision that went back to 1984. Collisions are going on now today in the F-ring, very, very dynamic situation. So that's all I had to say.
Great, Jeff. Okay, do we have any questions on the rings? Okay, well, in an effort to move things along, I will just very quickly do the last few slides, which is just a nice wrap-up of some fun facts. I'll just leave it there for you to read. We've got how many orbits, how much data was returned from the spacecraft, that sort of thing. How many maneuvers did we do? On slide 128 is one of my favorite statistics, which is how many miles did we travel this last year? And we traveled 89 million miles in year three. We used only 21 gallons of fuel, so our miles per gallon is about 3.5 million miles a gallon.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, one of my favorite statistics. Let's see. On slide 129, we have a nice summary of what to expect in year four, and just sort of want to draw your attention to two sort of very exciting things. The first one is that we have our one and only targeted Iapetus flyby of the mission and of the extended mission also. We're not in planning one in the extended mission. So that's in September of this year, and that should be very exciting, and hopefully we'll see some terrific stuff come out of that flyby. And also we have a couple of other non-targeted IC satellite flybys. Non-targeted just means we don't do maneuvers to control the spacecraft. We just let the spacecraft fly by. But both of these are less than 10,000 kilometers, so that makes them very close and very interesting to the scientists. We have Rhea on August 30th of this year, and we have Epimetheus on December 3rd of this year. And then finally, we have the last targeted Enceladus flyby of the Prime mission on March 12th next year. But for most of year four, what we're going to be doing is we're going to be increasing the inclination. Jeff just mentioned how exciting the observations were for rings when they got up to 50 and 55 degrees above the ring plane. Well, at the end of the Prime mission, we're going to crank up the inclination up to over 70 degrees above the ring plane. And that is, in fact, we will end the mission at our highest inclination. So that quickly sort of is our summary of what to expect in year four. The last slide, or the next slide, slide 130, is just a nice summary. That same one that I showed early, it's the mission planners, that shows the high inclination towards the end and also highlights the Iapetus flyby, sort of our two big highlights. Slide 131 is the list for your reference of the targeted flyby summaries for year four. And then the final slide of this fantastic presentation, slide 132, is just our website to remind everybody to go and take a look at our website. We try to update it every day with something new and exciting that the Cassini mission is doing or learning. And with that, we'll go ahead and see if there are any final questions.
Yes, I have a question.
Sure.
Where is the CHARM audio files that was mentioned very early in this presentation? I couldn't find them.
The CHARM audio files are online. They are very near the PDF that you downloaded. They usually become available about 24 to 48 hours after the telecon has occurred. And so
if you go to the place where you downloaded the PDF, you'll see in the column right next to that the audio files. And if you have any trouble,
an archive of older ones.
Oh yes, we have an archive
of
it.
I went to that site and I couldn't find them.
Yeah, so if you take a look at the invitation that you got originally, at the bottom is a some information for how to log into the password protected site.
No, I got that.
That has all the old audio files and all the old PowerPoints going all the way back to 2004.
Okay.
We only don't have audio files for the first two or three Charm Telecons because we didn't realize how important that was going to be, so we didn't make a recording of those. And I would, of course, you've just heard the three-year anniversary. Both the two-year and the one-year anniversary Charm Telecons were also fantastic.
Another question.
Sure.
You did the gas mileage thing, but have you done a calculation for the whole 10 years, roughly, of the mission, starting from the Earth all the way out?
I have not, but I can add that to my list of things to do because I know just how to find that information.
And then lastly, how did they do the 180-degree flip that was the clever thing that was discovered?
The 180-degree transfer is, so imagine that you are orbiting Saturn in an ellipse that's off-center. So Saturn is sort of off to one side. And so if you sort of, so imagine sort of your hands not in a circle but in an oval, and Saturn is off to one side. What they do is they crank the oval up high to about 50 degrees, but while they're doing that, they're making it more and more and more circular. And just at the moment, every time the spacecraft goes by Titan, it always goes by Titan inbound to Saturn, so it goes by sort of maybe imagine it on the left-hand side where the two are close. And as you circularize the orbit, you can get to a point where the orbit of Titan intersects both sides, and at that point, you sort of fix that side of it, and as you crank down, you let your other hand slide out, if that makes sense. I'm sort of doing it with my hands here in my office, but that, so if your left hand is fixed sort of right in front of you, and your right hand is sort of off to the side, maybe a foot and a half off to the side.
I mean, are you doing a rocket burn, or what?
Oh, what we do is we do a series of over almost 20 Titan flybys. It's not a single rocket burn. It's a whole bunch of little ones that happen at each Titan flyby. And we crank the orbits up to about 50 degrees. We circularize them, and then we crank them down. But we go up with the pedals on one hand, and we go down with the pedals on the other. So that's where it gets its name, 180-degree transfer. Are there any other questions? Well, I want to thank everybody for sticking with us. We went quite a bit over today, but I know that the anniversary telecon is one of our absolute most favorite from the listeners, and I want to thank the scientists. They did a fantastic job and taking their time out today to join us. Our next Charm Telecon will be the last Tuesday in July. That's Tuesday, July 31st. We don't know what the topic is yet, but that information will go out in an email. As it always does. And I want to thank everyone, in particular the scientists, for joining us today.
You're welcome.